Hello, and welcome back to Food Toxicology. My name is Greg Muller, and I'm the instructor for this course. Well, if we go back in history, we find that it was Paracelsus, the father of modern toxicology, that gave us the initial dose-response relationship, the title for today's lecture, in his much-quoted saying, it is the dose that makes the poison. And in fact, even in ancient times, people recognized that there were certain toxins and toxic properties of things, the poisons, if you will. What we're going to do today is actually to look at the quantitative relationship between dose response and how we in toxicology use that response to classify toxicants, to do some risk assessment, and to model the relationship between chemistry and biology, between chemicals and biological systems. Our learning objectives here today, we're going to try to understand this quantitative relationship between toxicant exposure and the induced effects, these responses, if you will. We're going to try to describe some frequently encountered toxic effects. What is the range of biological impacts that toxicants can have on the human body? We're going to try to interpret some of these mathematical relationships, these distributions, these frequency relationships in terms of dose response curves. How can we use this to model the dose and the toxicity relationship? We're going to try to use these as well to understand some of these threshold effects. At what point in the dose response relationship do we transition from no effect to perhaps a toxic effect of concern? We're going to try as well to understand some of the terminology associated with a quantization of dose response. These are things like effective dose, margin of safety, and the relationship of effective versus toxic dose. And you would have that effective versus toxic dose in something like a pharmaceutical drug. What is an antibiotic other than something that is anti-life? It's trying to kill a toxic effect, in this case on microbes. But you want to kill the microbe, kill the pathogen, but not the host. And so the idea is balancing these toxic dose against the host versus the effective dose against the pathogen. We're going to try as well to have some things where we use actual data for no observed effects and lowest observed effects. What happens when we cross those critical thresholds, and how do we use that information in risk assessment? We're going to try to summarize the effective, lethal, and toxic doses of and how dose response curves help us realize these numeric indicators of relative toxicity. We're also going to delve into carcinogenesis for the first time. Cancer is a non-threshold effect, and so we're going to try to understand how we have modeled the relationship between carcinogenesis as a toxic end effect and dose. Well, to start off, it's best to identify what in fact is a dose, and it is defined as the amount of a substance administered at one time. And that's in contrast to something called a dosage, which is the amount, unit weight of the exposed individual, okay? And sometimes we like, especially with subchronic or chronic exposures, where there are multiple doses, we like to have those dosages not only in terms of the amount per unit weight, but the amount per unit weight over time. We can characterize exposure by the number of doses, the frequency of dosing, and the total period of time for the exposure. Okay? You've probably heard that there are certain poisons, arsenic being one of them, where low dose exposure can actually enhance the biological response such that you are more resistant to toxicosis than perhaps somebody who hasn't been previously dosed. The biochemical machinery for biotransformation has been upgraded, so to speak, version 2.0 in your body because of this pre-exposure at very, very low doses. And this is a part of the relationship between an exposed individual and a toxic exposure. Sometimes those who have very good nutritional and health status have the biotransformation capability to respond to toxicant exposure better than some others. Well, we'd like to be able to quantify the dose universally, and we use the gram and the milligram, the basic SI units, to actually quantify exposures in toxicology. The dosage we use is typically, when we do it on a body weight basis is going to be a milligram per kilogram, and sometimes milligram per kilogram per day if we have a duration of an effect. These exposures, in terms of the toxicant and the media that we're exposed to, we typically will see milligrams per liter in water or parts per million, milligrams per kilogram in food materials, or milligrams per cubic meter in air. You will often hear the units, the common units, part per million or ppm or ppb, and you should know the relationships. A milligram per kilogram is equal to a part per million. One of the other things, while we're talking about units, and I would make sure that you recognize, even though we are doing mass-based units, there are some times in terms of looking at relationships, especially relationships between chemicals and biochemicals and toxicants, where we want to not fall into the trap of trying to compare mass units. For instance, the mass unit of a particular receptor with a particular toxin. In these cases, we go back to freshman chemistry when, in fact, molar relationships, the amounts of moles of toxicant and the moles of that receptor, perhaps a protein, is what is the relationship on a chemical basis. So make sure when you are quantifying the dose and doing some analysis, you're very aware of the units that you're using and the appropriateness of those units in that application. Well, some of the key concepts in dose response is that there is a mathematical relationship, and that mathematical relationship has a positive slope. What does that mean? That means that as we increase dose, we have an increase in response. This is critical in toxicology. Without that response, we don't have one of those things in toxicology that is explainable or modelable. This is a cause and effect relationship. These responses that we have to be observable. Now, if you look back in the past 25 years or so, with the rapid development of biotechnology and understanding of molecular biology, the subject matter of observable responses has changed significantly. What used to be perhaps a clinical manifestation of disease, a fever, a rash, some sort of macro analysis, modified perhaps until clinical diagnosis, blood analysis, enzyme analyses, perhaps tissue damage. Now we have the ability through molecular biology to actually look at molecular responses to exposure to toxicants. The question I will hand to you is a change in a molecular relationship, on a molecular basis, is that sufficient to regard it as an observable response for toxicosis? This is actually a question that's being asked because we do see the impacts, the modification of molecular biology in a response to a toxicant exposure. We see that, for instance, in low-dose dioxin exposure. The question is that observable response a toxicosis? And that is a question that is actually being debated. It's being debated currently, especially in the arena of safe levels of very toxic substances such as dioxin. In terms of the dose-response relationship, we also would like to be able to statistically manage all of the variability of individual responses. So sometimes we'd like to be able to look at gender effects, species effects, genetics, perhaps age, whether this is in animal models or in human models. And so the idea there is that populations have variability. Can we wean out that variability, for example, to see if, in fact, what we are observing is, in fact, a strict dose-response relationship or it has some strong influence by one of these factors? Well, it is good for us to take a look and understand perhaps the range of responses, these toxic end effects that we might have in terms of the dose-response relationship. And we'll go through this listing on the next few slides just to give you a sense of familiarity. We actually will cover several of these in detail, for instance, in target organ toxicology and some others where we actually will see in development on a molecular or tissue organismal basis what these end effects are like. One of the toxic effects we might see in toxicosis is an inflammation that may be a local or systemic response. We'll see necrosis or cell death. necrotic tissue, gangrene tissue, tissues that actually die off. They can die off because of the chemical relationship. For instance, if you look at the relationship of strong acids or strong bases, they actually will dissolve cell membranes and kill off cells. So we can develop necrotic tissue with the development of those toxicants, either primary or secondary. Enzyme inhibition, and that will yield some biochemical pathway interruption, or for instance, non-competitive or competitive inhibition. Sometimes we'll see in the area of neurotoxicity, cholinesterase inhibition, a key enzyme in neurotransmission that is interfered with by these chemicals and their relationship to receptors on the enzyme. We'll see instances of biochemical uncoupling, where we have an interference in some sort of biochemical pathway, like ATP biosynthesis. For example, pentachlorophenol, compound, a chlorinated hydrocarbon, used actively as an insecticide and a treatment of wood products like poles, is actually a biochemical uncoupling agent. We'll see as an end effect things like lethal synthesis, where in fact the toxicant is incorporated into a biochemical pathway. One of the toxicants we'll review here is fluoroacetate. Fluoroacetate is a compound that comes to us from nature, and this particular chemical compound in the gastrolobium species of plants in South America and Australia actually can interrupt the Krebs cycle and essentially shut down molecular energy mechanisms. Lipid peroxidation is another. We talk about quite often the importance of antioxidants in our diet. We'll do a whole segment in our target organ toxicology lecture about lipid peroxidation and oxidative stress. But the idea there is that there are many chemical reactions in terms of our normal respiratory functions that produce free radicals. And these free radicals have the ability to attack the lipid bilayer in cells and release all of those materials within cells, things like lysozymes, digestive enzymes, if you will, that can have a very damaging impact on the surrounding tissues. We can have, in terms of responses, things like covalent bonding, the alkylated mustard gases that actually will alkylate DNA. These are electrophilic reactive attacks on the DNA molecule. And so things like aflatoxins, mustard gas, will actually bind to DNA and perhaps cause mutagenesis. Receptor interaction, and we'll introduce in many segments of the lectures in food toxicology the potential for receptor interaction, and one of the major ones we'll deal with is endocrine disruption, where we have estrogens or false estrogens actually coming in and playing a role in terms of hormone receptor interactions. We'll also see immune-mediated hypersensitivity reactions where we actually have specific antigenic chemicals that actually result in an allergic reaction, the basis for a lot of food allergies and food sensitivities. We'll deal with a whole lecture on this particular subject area here in this course. As well, we'll have, in terms of a toxic response, things like immunosuppression. Dioxin is well known for its immune suppression, many chlorinated hydrocarbons as well. And this will give us not necessarily a direct toxicosis, but the indirect toxicosis where the immune suppression itself may not be lethal, but the byproducts of immune suppression, infection by pathogenic agents, will actually be the cause of morbidity and mortality in the subject. In terms of toxic responses, we also have cancer, the development of neoplasia. These are aberrant cell division and tissue growth. As you probably know, these come in two major varieties, those that are malignant or metastasizing carcinogenesis, and we also have neoplasms or tumors that develop that are not malignant tumors, oncogenesis. We will deal with carcinogenesis and the molecular basis for carcinogenesis in one of our lectures as well this semester. In terms of some other responses, we have things like genotoxic interactions where we have an interaction of the chemical with DNA and that can possibly lead to an inheritable change. Now think about this, that the parents are exposed to a toxicant, but it is in fact the offspring that suffer because of DNA damage. There is some potential for classogenic or chromosomal effects as well as mutagenic effects which have to do with base pairs. If we get false substitutions in terms of base pairs, we get inefficient, poor, or wrong coding for proteins, and those can have dramatic effects on the survivability of the organism. We also have as an end effect developmental and reproductive toxicity. This can happen once there is conception, exposure of the conceptus to developmental toxins. These will not only have adverse effects on conception, but we perhaps have teratogenesis, development problems with the structure and function of the conceptus. Now, some of the toxic responses that we deal with in toxicology are referred to as idiosyncratic. Okay? Idiosyncratic means it's somewhat specific to the individual. It's not a broad population necessarily based. It's perhaps segments of that population. Sometimes these are genetically determined sensitivities or resistances to toxicity. Okay? And typically you'll see these highly resistant or highly susceptible people show up on the normal distribution in terms of a large-scale population and their response to exposure to a particular toxin. Sometimes these individuals lack enzymes or some factors involved in the metabolism, and so there is a genetic defect or a genetic difference in this subpopulation or this small group of people. Sometimes these groups of people are not particularly small. About 10% of black males, about 400 million people worldwide, have a deficiency of glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase. This particular deficiency makes them susceptible to oxidative damage from oxidative compounds. For example, primaquine is an oxidative anti-malarial drug. Individuals that have this genetic deficiency will actually, because they lack this enzyme in their erythrocytes, they'll start oxidizing their red blood cells, go into hemolytic anemia, perhaps hemolytic crisis. It can be a very toxic exposure for these individuals. This is where the doctor-patient relationship is good in terms of predisposition, genetic predisposition to these particular deficiencies. And people know which subpopulations, which groups, which cultural, racial groups are more inclined to have these sorts of deficiencies or defects. You may have also heard of blue baby syndrome, where nitrates in drinking water, especially at high levels, the maximum contaminant level in drinking water is 10 parts per million. Many agriculturally impacted areas have significantly higher levels of nitrates. The problem in infants with methemoglobinemia or blue baby syndrome is that they actually, their gut converts that nitrate into nitrites, and they just don't have sufficient ability to oxidize that back. Some groups of people actually lack the NADH methemoglobin reductase enzyme, and they are highly susceptible to methemoglobinemia. And this is a oxidation of the ferrous iron on hemoglobin to ferric iron, poor for transport. So in fact, there has to be a reducing agent. The typical therapy for this is the dye that's used quite often in laboratories. Methylene blue is actually one of the therapies in veterinary animal toxicology used for nitrate toxicosis. Now, there are other types of toxic responses, and one of the most important in food toxicology, or perhaps common, is allergic reactions. And again, we'll deal with this in significant detail later in the course. This is an immunological mediated response, and so that means that there is some memory action in terms of how our immune system responds to this. Your immune system typically has an exposure, and if you think back to vaccination, we do an exposure that builds up the immune response. Typically that exposure is done with a adulterated pathogen, adulterated chemical, and even with allergy treatments, it's a dose of a material to help mediate that response. It does require, because it's using the immune system, this sensitizing exposure to develop these sorts of antibodies and responses. Small chemicals, people not only have allergies in terms of proteins and different compounds that are in food, this is typical, this is normal. These are large molecules, your immune system responds to large molecules. Your immune system, for a whole range of reasons and a lot to be self-preservation, is very insensitive to small molecules. But what might happen in terms of chemical sensitivity, and you probably have heard this, that some people have chemical sensitivity. Sick building syndrome is one of the terms that is used, especially in the popular press. What happens is these chemicals actually bind with various target proteins into a complex. This complex is formed and called a hapten. And this hapten then is what generates an immune-mediated response, okay? In allergies, in food allergies, there's an atypical dose response. Typically, small doses are the most effective, whereas large dose, there may be a bit more tolerance for it. This might have some relationship to the different types of cells, like the TS, suppressor T lymphocytes that actually help modulate the immune response so that it is not overactive. And so this is a complex area of immunology in terms of the relationship of allergic toxicants. Some of the end points in terms of allergic responses, we can find contact dermatitis. Whenever you're using a new product, they often on the label tell you to rub a little bit of it on the inside of your forearm, some sensitive skin there, to see if in fact you have an allergic reaction prior to perhaps putting it on your face or all over your body in some particular cases. What we also find is a general potential for general anaphylaxis or respiratory failure potential. This is a fairly life-threatening disease manifestation in terms of allergies. It is when you hear about death due to allergic responses and food toxicology, typically that's the disease manifestation is anaphylaxis. Some of the agents in terms of allergies, pollens, pesticides, sulfur, penicillin, the range goes on and on. In terms of food products, there are several dozen very reactive and active food allergens out there that affect a significant range of the population on the order of 1 to 3% of individuals. Now, in terms of dose response, we want to use this in terms of a quantitative analysis of incremental dose increase. So in developing these relationships, we're going to incrementally increase the dose and see the occurrence of a toxic end effect, a response, okay? And try to establish that relationship and see where critical thresholds are. As it turns out, because we're a biological population, when we do this, like things like body weight and eye color and many other things that have to do with organisms, these responses follow a normal frequency distribution or the so-called Gaussian distribution. On this slide, what I tell you here is just a breakdown of what a normal Gaussian distribution here is, just to give you an idea that on this axis, we are actually having a response to the same dose, and this is the number of individuals that respond to that particular dose. And so to define this population representation of variability, we'll see that under the so-called bell curve, the majority of individuals, or the average effect, is here in the center. The resistant individuals that actually suffer a minimal effect are down on the wing here. And on the other end, the other wing, we have the sensitive individuals that actually have a maximum effect in terms of exposure to the same dose. You've seen this perhaps in among your friends. You know people that perhaps are intolerant, have food intolerances to various things, whether it be wheat gluten or the alcohol or substances in wine. They have some food sensitivity to those. And you can kind of put yourself in here in terms of a particular exposure that you're aware of and your response. Do you have a minimal effect or a maximal effect in your own dietary exposure? Certain foods upset your stomach. You just don't have a good reaction to it. You have a different enzyme setup than perhaps some other individuals in handling that particular load of chemicals. In terms of a normal distribution, we can break this down in terms of standard deviations. Remember that one standard deviation in a Gaussian distribution represents 68% of the population, and then two standard deviations, we start getting to 95% of the population on either side of the mean response. On the wings, we have the very insensitive or the very highly sensitive individuals. Now, what that means is that the mean plus one standard deviation is going to help us define 68% of the population. Two standard deviations, we start encompassing over 95%, and then we get up to 99.7. And so this actually gives us the ability to encompass different segments of a population distribution, and we're going to use this in the analysis. When we actually take this frequency curve, how frequent an occurrence happens, and transpose that to cumulative. In other words, at low doses, there's not many. We plot this as a cumulative graph. This gives us the more famous, perhaps, sigmoid dose response curve. This is the classic representation of dose and response, again, sigmoidal. And what happens essentially is that you see in a sigmoidal curve that as dose is escalated, and this is the response, this is the cumulative response from 0 to 100%, at some point in time you increase dose such that every member of that particular population now is covered in terms of an exposure, even the sensitive individuals. The resistant individuals down here, we cross a threshold. They can be dosed significantly. We'll cross a threshold where we first, in terms of our data, and this is a significant point that I'd like to make here, is we call these threshold points where we actually have data. And you'll see error bars on here, okay? So we kind of know the statistical interpretation, the statistical validity of that particular point. But as we come up in terms of a dose response experiment, and this can be with rodents, in a rodent assay, this could be, for instance, in a phase two clinical trial with a drug like an antibiotic in terms of a dose response. Obviously, the response is going to be a favorable response that might be elimination of a particular pathogen. Another thing that you see around here is that there is a shallower slope here, a very strong slope here, and then a plateau region here as we approach 100% of the individuals. Now, in terms of observed effects, there are key components in this sigmoidal dose response curve as we incrementally increase dose. As we start off, we see a point where we first, in fact, the highest dose that we have within our data set where we don't observe adverse effects is called the no observed adverse effects level, or the no observed effects level, okay, the NOAEL. This is a key component in terms of risk assessment because the idea is that doses underneath this critical data point are going to not have an effect on a particular population. Now, if this is the last study, I'm not so sure I want this particular NOAA applied to me, because although my friends might be rats, I am not a rat. And so in terms of species differences and comparative toxicology, we'll start applying safety effects to this, typically on the order of 10, 100, or 1,000 dealing with this. But these no observed effect levels are critical importance, as are the lowest observed adverse effect levels, the LOELs. This is the first data point on a sigmoidal dose response plot that actually gives you the indication of toxicity. And again, these are actual data points in the dose response trials in a toxicology trial. Okay, so these are not models, these are not extrapolations at this point, these are actual data points. Now, it's important that we try to get as much information about the behavior of the dose response in the individuals to make some modeling predictions that we can use in risk assessment. Why do a dose response trial with rats and the tremendous loss of life in a toxicology trial if we're not going to use that to its best means? One of the ways we use these toxicology trials is to develop toxic thresholds of various kinds. One, for instance, of interest to us is when 50% of the population actually suffer that particular toxic endpoint. That's called the LD50, or the lethal dose 50, and that allows us to come up with a number, a dose, where we can predict that 50% of a given population is going to have a toxic effect, the middle point, the median point of that curve. That's really important in terms of risk assessment. It allows us to say, listen, this is how we're going to compare different chemicals. We're going to give that key number. So the LD50 of one chemical might be a fraction less than another chemical and therefore much more toxic. Its lethal dose is very low compared to something like table salt or sugar, where the lethal dose might be quite high on a relative basis. Now, how do we actually interpret these LD50s, LD50? This is used to compare toxicity between different toxicants, different chemicals. You got to remember that these only measure lethality, okay? It doesn't measure, and you'll see here in a moment, that there are differences in the shape and the slope of these curves. So it's not necessarily the best comparison, but it is a comparison that is actively used. It's better for quantile data where we actually have a good dose response set that shows a very clear increase of responses with incremental increases in dose. It's best for acute exposure, not necessarily for chronic dosing. It tells nothing about the slope or how fast we're going to get there. An LD50 in one case might have a very shallow slope compared to a very steep slope, and we'll see what the problems that will do in terms of predictive toxicology. It allows us as well to specifically quantify at least one aspect of the potential toxicant level of a particular chemical. Now, in terms of the shape and slope of these sigmoidal curves, on this particular slide, you'll see a blue curve and a red curve, toxicant A for in the red and toxicant B in the blue. And you can see that our thresholds are about the same. You can see that, in fact, the toxicant A curve rises very rapidly. The slope change here across a very small amount of dose is significant. In other words, if this is a toxic end effect, you don't want to find yourself in this dose regime, because the jump from perhaps 10-15% of the population up to perhaps 70 or 80% of the population is over a very small dosage regime. For toxicant B here in the blue, you see that this is a much gentler slope. The rise over run is significantly shallower, and you can see that over that same dose range, there's actually a smaller increment in terms of population effects of the toxic end effects. So this is good for analysis, or using comparative analysis of these curves for particular toxicants, and it helps us identify some of the risks associated with that. Obviously, in terms of drugs and therapeutics, you would want something that was more like toxicant B, that had a gradual slope, rather than a very sharp slope, only because there's critical potential for overdosing and the appearance of toxic end effects. Now, it allows us to do that comparative toxicity, and here you can see that the endpoint for a toxic dose for 10% of the population here is about the same for both, but the range of dose in terms of increasing dose is quite a bit for toxicant B. It's quite shallow between the toxic dose for 10% to 50% here in toxicant A. Again, to make the point that shape does matter when you're looking at these dose response curves. Now, these dose response curves can be used in many different types of applications. Some of these applications allow us to come up with these critical toxicology comparison values. Sometimes these are referred to as effective dose, or ED, and these are typically used with pharmaceuticals. And so we would like to develop a pharmaceutical that had an effective dose for 90%, 99% of the population as administered. When you buy the bottle of aspirin and you take the two aspirin to get rid of your headache, you'd like to see a favorable response there, 99%. You would not like to see lethality, and so that lethality concentration has to be far away from that effective dose concentration. We have effective concentrations in vivo called ECs, and so these are helpful in terms of doing therapeutic monitoring of drugs. If a certain bloodstream concentration is required for the end effect, this is monitored with ECs. Sometimes we use ECs in environmental toxicology, for instance, to develop either lethal concentrations or effective concentrations in terms of toxicants, for instance, in aquatic toxicology in water. We have a term called the LD low, which is sometimes referred to as the lowest published toxic dose. This is based on typically human or animal clinical studies, where we've seen toxicosis. As you probably understand, we don't do toxicology trials on humans. But humans do silly things sometimes. They expose themselves to toxins. And sometimes there's workplace exposures. Sometimes there's suicide. Someone drinks a bottle of pesticide in an attempt to kill themselves. Sometimes we have just inadvertent exposures, and these develop clinical cases in terms of the medical monitoring and workup of these cases, and they give us some insight into the human response to this particular toxicosis. The Hazardous Substance Database on the course website is full of the citations of clinical reports of poisonings and toxicoses associated with a particular chemical. And so the idea is this volume of clinical literature helps us establish that a certain concentration of a material will actually have a toxic end effect in a human. This is a demonstrated. This is not a planned study. This is a clinical observation. One of the things that we use dose response curves for is in the development of pharmaceuticals, and so we would like to make sure that we want the desired effect, but we don't want a toxic effect. And so we develop the concept of a therapeutic index, and you'll hear this quite often in the development of pharmaceuticals. A therapeutic index is simply the ratio of the LD50, or the lethal dose for 50% of the population, over the effective dose for 50% of the population. This is very helpful in terms of drug design, toxicology trials associated with drugs, the benefits testing in phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 trials that precede allowing a pharmaceutical to be marketed as a drug in the marketplace. The larger the ratio, obviously, the greater the safety. So we actually want therapeutic indices on the order of 10 or greater to make sure that these numbers are very, very high. The slope of the dose response in this is important as well. Another concept in terms of dose response curves is the development of an effective dose versus a toxic dose. And here, what we see is that their effective dose is what is the desirable relationship. And again, this is the response, 0 to 100%. Key indicators at 10, at 90, and at 99%. This is the desirable endpoint. This is the relief of the headache. This is the onset, for instance, in aspirin of stomach bleeding from overdose or kidney failure. And so you want to make sure that the separation between these two is significantly high. You don't want this particularly close, and our therapeutic index will actually tell us that. We'll also develop a margin of safety in terms of the relationship of the effective dose and the toxic dose. The margin of safety is calculated as the lethal dose for 1%. Here we've got lethal doses, not just toxic doses for things like bleeding of the stomach lining. This is lethality. And so the margin of safety is something that's held significant because one of the worst endpoints or responses in toxicosis is death of the patient. Now, if this is a life-threatening disease, your margin of safety in terms of a therapeutic regimen, you might allow yourself to go to perhaps 3 to 1. Or the idea, again, killing the pathogen but not killing the host. But if the pathogen is going to kill the host, then you've got a situation where perhaps life-threatening therapies may be the call because the outcome of the disease is probably not going to be good. The idea here, same sort of thing, the LD for 1% of population over the effective dose for 99% of the population. Essentially, how far is this safety? The idea here again is the ability to separate or at least quantify the relationship between toxic end effects and therapeutic positive goals. Margin of safety does account more for slope differences. And again, it's the lethal dose for 1% of the population over the effective dose for 99% of the population. But neither the therapeutic index or the margin of safety works for chemicals that don't have a beneficial effect. So just toxicants don't, you can't calculate margins of safety because there's no positive effect that you can calculate it from. And it's good for repeated dose trials. This is typically a one therapy trial. There are many therapies that are pretty toxic therapies. When you think about cancer therapies and chemotherapy, these are very, very highly toxic cytotoxic chemicals that are typically given to the patient. There's a tremendous discomfort associated with these chemicals. But the idea is one of this is a life-threatening disease, and perhaps we can have a shallower margin of safety in terms of therapeutic regimen. Now, one of the end effects that we talked about is carcinogenesis, and the thing that you need to understand about cancer is that it is a non-threshold effect. And so as a non-threshold effect, it's hard to be able to use a no-observed adverse effect level because it doesn't really have that same sort of threshold relationship. In fact, the one molecule, one hit theory of cancer says that one molecule will damage or mutate one cell, and that cell then becomes carcinogenic and has unrestricted replication, oncogenesis. So we develop, in terms of carcinogen risk assessment, the linearized multi-stage model. And this assumes no threshold effect. And what this does is it allows us to use a linear extrapolation through a zero threshold dose from the upper confidence level of the lowest dose that caused cancer in an animal study. I'll show you how that appears on a dose response curve. But that's important, a linear extrapolation through the zero threshold dose of the upper confidence level of the lowest dose that caused cancer in an animal study. And so this allows us to extrapolate that information as a cancer slope factor. And so in cancer risk assessment, you will hear people ask or be able to develop these slope factors, and that allows us to compare the relative carcinogenicity of two chemicals, if something's got a significant versus an insignificant slope factor. That slope factor here on this graph is developed. We've got our sigmoidal curve, so we've got a dose and we have some sort of risk of cancer from 0 to 100%. So we have our standard sigmoidal curve. The difference here is we pull this point, which is the lowest dose that caused cancer. And remember, these are replicated studies with highly statistical significant in terms of the numbers that they use to come up with these numbers, but we use the upper bound confidence level, the top of this standard deviation. And in fact, we then extrapolate down to the zero threshold dose. And so the idea here is that any dose above zero has the potential to cause cancer, okay? And so the idea here is that there are actual test results that show us in an animal study that there is carcinogenesis. We take that, and because it is something we know the least about, probably because it takes so long to develop cancer even in animal studies, sometimes multiple year studies, that this is the safest mechanism that we've come up with in terms of risk assessment of carcinogens. Now, there are other models that we use actively in risk assessment. This list is not comprehensive at all. I've talked about the one-hit model for cancer. The multi-hit model is another, that there's multiple events prior to cellular activation, includes the use of promoters that promote development of these cancerous cells. In terms of modeling, we use it quite often in risk assessment, but what is risk assessment other than trying to predict potential outcomes of exposure, sometimes that we don't have, and so we can establish the appropriate margins of safety in terms of how we weight the benefits versus the risks of particular chemicals in the environment, in the food system, in our workplace. Sometimes we do these models, we will actually model them to make them a little bit simpler. We'll transform them like the Probit model where we do a linearization transformation. I'll show you here in a moment how we do that. Sometimes we'll actually have enough interest in the relationship of the toxicant and the organism that will go through a very highly developed pharmacokinetic model. The PBPK is the physiologically based pharmacokinetic model for typically for lead. I shouldn't say typically, but it's the most well-developed for lead. Lead exposure has historically been of great concern. It has an impact in terms of developmental toxicity and acute toxicity and chronic toxicity along the whole range of human development. It's important enough to us as a exposure and as a toxin in our environment and our food system that scientists have invested tremendous amounts of resources over the past decades to develop a very sophisticated molecule, a model to model the whole range of activities across tissues in terms of dietary exposure, airborne exposure, and come up with a predictor in terms of blood lead levels, especially childhood blood lead levels, that allow us to do very active risk assessment with lead. Now, in terms of transformation of variables, we use this in risk assessment and development of dose response relationships to essentially work up quite a bit more data and information and increase the quality of the information that we have resulting typically from animal studies or from clinical trials. It does allow for some simpler analysis of the data points of interest. If you think about it, take a look at those sigmoidal curves, and the area of great interest is where the data is changing rapidly, that very sharp increase in slope in the middle part of the curve. To be able to predict or do any risk-based analysis where things are changing rapidly in terms of dose and response is going to set you up to having highly inaccurate predictions. And so can you do some mathematical transformations to that data set to allow you to have a better predictive model? Some of the examples in terms of toxicology and having a good background in statistics is very valuable for those that are going to do dose response toxicology. We'll see probit transformation. That's one of the mathematical. It's based on a Gaussian bell curve. We'll see a Loggit transformation. The Loggit transformation takes the log odds of a quantile response. And then there's another one called the Weibull transformation. These are some of the statistical manipulations, the representations, transformations that we use of the data to, again, wean out some information and then to see the statistical significance of those results. Now, in a probit transformation, we'll go through this in an example just to illustrate this. You'll hear a lot about probits and risk assessment through probit transformation. It's one of the more popular ways to do it, and it's a little bit easier. This is not a statistics class. It's a little bit easier for students to understand. What we do in a probit transformation is we actually develop the concept of probability units, and we coin the phrase probits as probability units. And in doing this transformation, we convert the percent response of the units of deviation, the standard deviation, from the mean normal equivalent deviations, or NEDs, okay? These normal equivalent deviations have a relationship to those standard deviations that we develop in the Gaussian curve. And so the NED for a 50% response, because there is no deviation, it is the mean, is zero. In our probit approach, what we're going to do, because it's not so interesting to deal with negative numbers, you got to remember that the bell curve has two sides to it. It has a side to the left and a side to the right in terms of the standard deviation. And so rather than call it a minus standard deviation and a plus standard deviation, we're just going to go ahead and add 5, and we're going to avoid negatives. And so we're just going to decide to do that. We're doing a transformation. We can make decisions to do that as long as we track those decisions. So in a probit transformation, if we take a look at the percent response here on this particular graphic, a tenth of a percent all the way up to 99.9%, as we look at the standard deviations off the mean, one standard deviation, two standard deviations, three in terms of the population variability, we convert that into these normal equivalent distributions, and then all we do is add 5 to that. And so a probit number, the probit that we come out with is 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 for those NEDs, those standard deviations off the mean, okay? And so that allows us to do a transformation of numbers. And why do we want to do a transformation of numbers? We want to do it to simplify, to make sure that we can essentially linearize that highly rapidly moving area in the central part of a sigmoidal graph. Another thing we'll do in a probit transformation is we'll take a log transformation of the dose, and this allows us to assume a log normal distribution, which is reasonable in biological systems. And what this does when we are all done, when we've done those two transformations, probit transformations of the frequency of occurrence and a log transformation of the dose, it allows a near linear plot. And when we have a linear plot, it allows us to do fairly straightforward linear regression analysis. So here's our log normal distribution of, in this case, mortality frequency as a function of dose. So we do this probit unit transformation as we just have gone through, and now we see these probit units developed. And so we have 3, 3.5, 4, 5 is the mean response, and we can develop this. And you'll notice something about this probit transformation. It has given us a nice flat curve. It's not rapidly changing in the middle. And so it allows us to get these numbers to a high degree of sensitivity. And so it just simplifies our life, gives us a little bit more confidence in the total outcome. Probit unit transformations are very useful, as are many of the statistical transformations, in the development of toxicology data. A summary then for dose response relationships. It's critical, it's key in terms of the quantitative assessment of toxicology. It gives us a normal frequency distribution. It gives us an arithmetic dose to log dose transformation in terms of the curve. We take this frequency data and we change it to cumulative. We change that cumulative response to probabilities and develop NEDs. We change these NEDs to probits by adding 5, and that gives us a dose response curve. So that gives us a final ability to finally summarize dose response relationships and how we do those, what we get out of those in terms of major parameters. Perhaps the most useful term is the median lethal dose, the LD50, in terms of comparing toxic. It's a very handy, very useful thing, as long as you're very aware of the limitations. It is just a snapshot of the range of potential toxicology, toxicodynamics, toxicomechanics of this particular chemical compound. We need to be very aware of the slope of a dose response curve. We need to be able to understand how we can extract thresholds for risk assessment. We need to understand that at some point in time, and this could be in a desirable end effect, like in a therapeutic drug, that at some point, at some dose, there will be a saturation of the dose to the response. And this is good in terms of planning for dose in terms of clinical studies and final formulation of a medicine. Dose response curves allow us to do comparative toxicity of two chemicals, and that's extremely useful. If I am a regulator and I'm going to compare the use of two chemicals, agricultural chemicals, pesticides, that have the same efficacy in terms of herbicidal activity, but in terms of comparative toxicity, one has significantly higher mammalian toxicity, I think I'm going to encourage the use of the lower toxicity, and LD50s help us to directly compare two chemicals. So it does allow us to have a handle on risk assessment. It's one of the final things that allows us to take this quantitative use of toxicology data and actually use it in our daily lives in terms of managing risk versus benefit of many of our activities. Well, that gives us a sense of this relationship that is critical and fundamental in toxicology called dose response. Next time, the lecture, what we'll do is we'll actually start into the pathways of toxicosis, the first pathway in terms of the chemistry and biology interface is absorption of toxicants as we cross that barrier. Until that time, we'll see you. Thank you.